Welcome back to Nerdball. I'm Tucker Richardson here with Simon Gersberg. We have a very exciting pod today. We're having one of my former coaches on the pod. But first, Simon, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. I'm excited to have Coach on. Should be a good one today.
Yeah, so today we have Coach Mantegna on, and I'm really excited to have him on because he's obviously one of my coaches, one of my mentors in my life. He's the head basketball coach at Blair Academy, a New Jersey high school powerhouse where I attended my post-grad year. He's been at Blair for over 20 years and has coached numerous NBA players and high-level college basketball players. He's been a part of USA Basketball, and he's just a legend in the basketball community. So it's really a pleasure to have you on today, Coach. How are you doing? How's quarantine treating you?
Guys, it's a pleasure to be on. I've been going on my runs and listening to the Nerdball podcast, so I think I'm a Nerdball groupie at this point. Quarantine's been great. Appreciate you having me on, and we're just getting through it.
Yeah, what's it like at Blair? It must be pretty lonely because it's kind of a very secluded place with no one on campus. So what's that like? I guess you get family time and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my youngest son was away at junior boarding school. My oldest son was away at the University of Richmond. So extra time with them, they had to cut that short in the spring. And, you know, listen, being in a rural area during this stage of 2020 in quarantine has not been bad. You know, a lot of places to exercise, lots of places to go for walks. We have our own golf course here. And a back porch that I'm sitting on right now that we can socialize in a safe way. So I feel blessed I'm not living in Brooklyn right about now.
Coach, what are you shooting these days?
I'm about a 7 or 8 handicap, Simon. Are you ready for me with that? Or are you?
No, I'm not a golfer. I'm not a golfer.
So talking about quarantine, I was just curious. Obviously, I know a lot of the Blair guys and guys that have been there. So I was wondering just how it's affecting your players, especially like with recruitment and things like that, with AAU getting mostly canceled. How is that going? How have you been in touch with coaches or in touch with your players? Like, how's that whole process going?
Yeah, that's really a nuanced question, Tuck. I mean, you know, early on in March and April, we have a number of our players that parents are in the healthcare community. So there was some real fear, and there was some couple of moms really putting their lives on the line daily. So for us to talk about recruiting or individual skill development in March and April and even into May just didn't seem right. And then when we were just getting back into starting to talk about basketball, then we had the Black Lives Matter stuff happening and the protests and a lot of unrest, and we pivoted again, and we really jumped into that hard on our team Zooms. And so much of what we've been doing has been non-basketball related during the quarantine. I do feel there's some normalcy in the last sort of 6 weeks. Guys have been able to start to train again, whether it be inside or outside. But what I loved about it was both dealing with people fearing for their lives and also dealing with the Black Lives Matter protests. It was great. I mean, we really found that we had deep relationships and that we could talk about and be there for each other when it came to way more important things than basketball.
I agree. And I feel like it's such a difficult time right now, or difficult and important time to be like a young kid that has a lot of difficult questions he has to ask, difficult conversations. That's what we've been doing. Same at Colgate. Like, we've had a lot of really interesting, deep conversations with our team. That's been really important. So I'm glad that you guys have been doing that. And I'm sure it's very difficult for guys that do have aspirations to play in college or you know, that those are their career goals, to kind of put that to the side and focus on maybe the bigger or more important issues right now. But I had a question just in terms of what it's like to be a coach at Blair and a prep school coach in general. So you talk a lot about your relationships with your players, and you have built great relationships with your players. So I was wondering what it's like when you usually only get guys for maybe 1 or 2 years, and do you wish that you had more time with guys, like maybe a guy like Jalen Blakes, who's been there since the beginning and you've been able to build a relationship for 4 years. What's that like being a prep coach, and what kind of challenges do you face with that?
Well, I have a number of guys for 4 years, and a lot of impactful guys I've had for 3 years. And then we mix in the 1 and 2 year guys that you speak of. So it's a real mixed bag in terms of that. I mean, I think relationships are relationships. If you're a relationship builder, you should be able to get deep into a relationship pretty quickly. And I think when you when you have the common bond of a team and common bond of adversity and common bond of sharing dreams and goals and aspirations with people, I mean, I think our relationships deepen pretty quickly. I mean, look at you and I, right? I mean, by the time you left after your 1 year, I thought we were pretty close and I, you know, knew your family and cared a lot about you and hopefully vice versa. So yes, I mean, relationships are different depending on how many years guys have been here. But the bottom line is, I think a situation where we all live together, we all compete together, we all face adversity together, I think relationships are built very quickly here. I think it's sort of a turbo relationship builder at boarding school. I think you might think the same.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I always tell people that it was like, because I could have maybe gone to Colgate before and I could have done it after 4 years, but I'm still so happy that I did that fifth year, because just like you're saying, being able to live on campus with people, being able to live with people your age that kind of have the same goals as you and have the same aspirations as you, it's such a critical part of, I think, my development, at least before going to college. And I was really happy that I got to do that.
We were also happy you got to do that, Tucker. Made me a better coach that year. I looked a little smarter than I probably was that year you played for me.
Yeah, it was really fun. But yeah, Simon, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been waiting to ask this question since I met Tuck. Who would win in one-on-one, Tuck or Luol Deng? Both in their prime. Let's hear it. You coach Luol. I got to know. I got to know.
Well, listen, I don't think I had either guy in their prime, maybe in their high school prime. You know, Lou went on to be a two-time NBA All-Star, so I might take Lou by a hair, but Tucker was a pretty darn good Blair player on a championship team, and I watch a lot of CBS Sports Colgate games, CBS Sports Network Colgate games as well, and he's a pretty daggone good player at Colgate as well.
I still got some time to catch up to Lou. We'll see.
That's true.
So we just wanted to kind of get into how you kind of use analytics. And I know in high school it's a little different, but you mentioned that you do some shot quality stuff, or you do some of that stuff at Blair. So we were wondering what your experience is with that and how you kind of utilize that.
Yeah, well, I want to bounce some of this stuff off of especially Simon, who seems to be the expert on this. I went to a coding system that I stole from a combination of Klatsky, Zach Bovaire, who's an assistant at West Point, who you guys probably know in your conference, and Dave McLaughlin, who's the head coach at Dartmouth, and I think is one of the smartest basketball guys that I've met in my 30 years in the business. And I've sort of fine-tuned it, and my problem with the shot quality stuff, I think we've got it to a point where I really like it, and I'll share it with you guys in a second. My problem at the high school level is I don't have enough bodies to sort of do it real-time and to be able to give like next day feedback on shot quality as much as I would like to. You know, if I had a sort of fourth assistant coach who could do shot quality every night after we played and deliver it back to my team, I think it could be more useful. A lot of our shot quality stuff we do at the end of years or the end of a month. And it informs my staff and I, but I don't think I do a good enough job informing our players in real time about our shot quality, which is ultimately what you use it for. I mean, it's nice to go back and debrief the season using shot quality, and I can tell you what our codes are, but I wish I could do it, and maybe I just need to make it a priority, but that, you know, we're not helping the players enough with it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest challenge, because there's a learning curve with the stuff, but the most important part is also communicating it in a simple fashion to the players. So is the scale you use like 1 to 5 on each shot, or what is it?
Yeah, so I'll share with you real quick if you really want to nerd out. The scale is 0 to 5, and 5 being an uncontested layup. And I changed this year, an assisted uncontested 3, because Tucker's buddy Jalen Blakes likes to shoot a lot of 3s off the bounce. And I just don't think that's a 5-point top shelf shot for our team, so we went to assisted uncontested 3s, and then and 4 points would be a 3-point minimal contested layup or a foul. Would you put a foul there, Simon?
So our scale is a little different, so okay. I don't really know how that actually grades out with the foul. Wait, so would you say it's 4 again? So 5.
4 would be a minimal contest 3-pointer and a contested layup and a foul. I never know where to put the fouls,
though. Foul's a 4 then, like based off the expected value.
Okay. And then 3 is an uncontested mid-range or a heavily contested 3, which we don't really like those 3 points. Two is a contested mid-range. And here's the other wrinkle that we changed a couple years ago. One is a dead ball turnover, and zero is a live ball turnover.
Ooh, interesting.
Which we had never done that before. I stole it from someone, and I would give them credit. I can't remember which one of those three guys I mentioned I stole it from. This is all stolen, by the way. but I do like the idea of a live ball turnover being even worse than a dead ball turnover, where at least they can't run out into transition. So that's how we break it down. It's six categories. Anytime we can get over three is good. We've been too high a turnover team, so those zeros and ones just absolutely kill the averages, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
And I know that's pretty antiquated or simple, but it's high school, and I do think it gets the message across.
And I think that's how the Colgate team used it. It was before I actually got there, but that's how most colleges are actually doing it, 0-5.
Okay.
And I think in the last couple of years, it's kind of evolved, or at least the coaches like Kalatsky, I'm not sure about Dartmouth actually, but have evolved to the expected value scale, looking at the percent chance the shot has of going in times the type of shot, just because it's more specific. So like 0-5, it works and it's easy for players to conceptualize. But I think like for total accuracy, it probably like the expected value that Klatsky and like the shot quality website will use is the next step, I guess, like progression, like 5 years, however, whenever that is.
So let me ask you this follow-up question to that then. Because I did listen to your pod last week about the shotquality.com, which was great. Is it each player's expected outcome from each spot on the floor?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it can't do an average, because obviously like Tuck shooting a spot up is so much better than like an average center or someone like that. So
how do you garner that data? How many shots does Tucker need to take at Colgate before you realize what his expected quality is at each spot? I mean, that's what I struggle with. If I wanted to take the next step, I don't know how I would arrive at those numbers.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just coded it. So you start at the 50th percentile. And the code learns really quickly. It just learns how Tuck's performance is on each variable and then adjusts based off the shots he takes. So he probably needs like 3-5 shots, and then it'll like find his mean or average.
Okay. Cool.
But you do need to – you would have to take like shots from each spot, like, because so that way it knows like where on each spot on the floor maybe you shoot better, or like if you shoot better contested. So the more shots you take, the more accurate it would be, basically.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And the other issue at high school is we don't have the play-by-play data. So for us to even take that next step, we'd have to do our own play-by-play data. This is fascinating stuff, though. I'm so interested in it. I had like all these questions I was thinking of when I was running the other day and listening to your guys' shot quality pod. I mean, I think it's really cool. Are NBA teams already doing this, Simon?
Yes, I believe. I mean, they got to. I mean, I don't personally know, but they have to be. I mean, like with Second Spectrum, I think that's what they use, but that's a very, very expensive product that most college and high school teams just cannot afford.
Sure. That's what I figured. It was from the Spectrum. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Simon, I'm on the right track in a simplified way then, Simon. You would say.
I'd say,
you know, I've copied the right people, basically, is what I'm asking you.
You definitely have. With the data that you have available, I mean, I think you're doing it perfectly. It's just the next 5 years, maybe you change the next step. I don't know how it'll work out, but something like that.
Right.
Yeah, so Simon, I was going to ask you, how would a high school program be able to use it better if they just don't have the kind of play-by-play stuff? Would they would need eventually to get more play-by-play data before they can use something like shot quality?
Well, I mean, this year for Colgate, I mean, before I was automating it, I mean, I did it in the subjective fashion where, I mean, you know all the players, coach. So, like, when you see someone take a jump shot, you pretty much know their percentages. I mean, just like, I mean, you don't know them exactly, but you could be like, this guy's a 40% three-point shooter. This guy's a 35% two-point shooter. And once you just, like, practice with it, like, the subjective fashion works out. And that's how Klatsky's been doing it for, like, 3 years. It's just the automated version is just objective, so it's a little better. But the subjective version, I mean, it works and it's specific. It's just a little harder to conceptualize for the players.
Yeah, that's I have pretty bright kids, but that is the last piece. But this is so much better than in 2001 when I was just yelling, that's a freaking bad shot. You know what I mean? Which is really how we all coached in a different generation. And players are different then too, because there was a certain era where you just, the coach told you what to do and you did it. And, you know, maybe that was sort of even before I started coaching, but I love to have data to back up what I'm saying to guys, and to make every interaction less confrontational and more data driven. It's just a better way to interact with people and a better way to coach, frankly, especially when you're coaching kids in 2020.
Yeah. Just with the random coaches that I've talked to, like, they'll say, the player will be like, that's a good shot for me. And then you show them the data, like, no, this is not a good shot for you. You shot this percentile on this shot. Like, you shouldn't be shooting it in the future. And I think that's where it'll move to in the future, first shot quality.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly valuable. And then the flip side is not being limited by these numbers, then getting in the gym in the springtime after the season and trying to up your – you know, shot, up your quality, up your talent, up your skills, so that your numbers move in an upward trend the following year. I mean, what I don't want the numbers to do is limit a guy, you know, and that's, if you want to nerd out on coaching, that's really interesting part of coaching, right? You're trying to get guys to play a role and help their team win, but at the same time, you want them in time to expand their role and become better. And that's a really, that's a fine line. A lot of guys have trouble with that in college when they've been the best player on their high school team. They get to college and they're asked to play a role. You don't want to limit them to that role for 4 years at Colgate, but at the same time, as a freshman, you know, you just may need to defend and rebound to get on the court for 10 minutes a game. And I think a lot of guys that don't go to places like Blair, where they play with other good guys, I think they struggle with that when they get to college. I think that's why people like Klatsky like to recruit guys from programs like ours, because they've already played a role. Anyway, that's a tangent, but that's that. I think that all is goes along with it.
It's so true, and it's interesting because we always look at, especially the last couple of years, I think almost every player on our team did at least 5 years of high school. So they did like a prep year, or they reclassed and went to a prep school or whatever. So that is so interesting that you say that, because if I had maybe just gone to Colgate straight from Hunter and Central, where I didn't, obviously in AAU, I played with higher level players, but building your role, like you're saying, is so important. I definitely agree with that. How do you think that the high school game has evolved in the last like 10 years? Because you see in the NBA, the evolution of the game is so quick, like the taking 3-point shots and the Harden era guys. Have you seen the same sort of evolution in high school, or is it a little bit more gradual? What are you noticing from that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely noticing an evolution, right? I mean, I think basketball is a trickle down. It trickles down from the NBA and the EuroLeague, and then it trickles down into college. I mean, I don't watch a whole lot of college basketball anymore. I mean, other than watching guys like you, Tucker, who I coach, I find college basketball pretty unwatchable in a lot of ways. I think it's overcoached sometimes. There's so much faux action on offense. And it's super structured, and I just don't find it very interesting to watch. And I think a lot of the best players at the highest levels, they're not in college anymore. They go right to the pros, which they should do, or they're one and done, which I don't blame them for. But it leaves the quality at the highest level. It leaves a lot of 18 and 19-year-olds playing high-level college basketball, which, frankly, I don't find that interesting to watch in a lot of cases, because a lot of them don't know how to play. And then the coaches, these great coaches, have to dumb the game down for 18, 19-year-old kids because they don't have any IQ yet, and nor should they. It's not their fault. If they, you know, if it was 30 years ago, they stayed in college for 3 or 4 years, they would learn how to play basketball, but they don't. And again, I don't fault them for going off to the NBA early when they can get their money. But so to answer your question, yes, I think we're all playing with more pace and space. I mean, we haven't run a post up in 3 years at Blair. We literally haven't posted anybody up for 3 years. We're playing fast as could be. And then, you know, defensively too, right? You watch all these NBA teams switching so much. We do a lot of switching. We ice ball screens on the side for those of you coaching nerds out there. I think there's an obvious trickle down factor. But there's a really wide range of coaching at the high school level, Tucker, as you know. Right. You played for a really good coach, Coach Falco, at Hunter and Central. You know, there are a lot of coaches that are still coaching like, you know, it's the 1980s, maybe when they played. So, you know, I try to just – there's no excuse to be that way right now between YouTube and Twitter and all – everything that's available to us. I can watch the Turkish EuroLeague games on my computer at 1 in the morning. So there's no excuse to be caught 30 years in the past unless you just don't care about your own growth.
Well, that's so interesting because that leads right into my next question. So I think the most valuable thing a coach can do is be amorphous and malleable. So adjust based off the talent you have. So running different ball screens based off having a more athletic team or less athletic team, or maybe shooting more threes, or maybe running even post-ups if you have a big guy. So how have you seen your team evolve in the last 5-10 years based off your talent? Have you adjusted different screen coverages or certain shot types or something like that?
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we started playing differently Tucker's year because, frankly, I didn't think we were going to be very good. Yeah. And we didn't have a center who could post up that year. And so I just decided we're not going to be good anyway relative to what we've been. I'm going to experiment this year. And then we were great in large part because I didn't realize how good Tucker was. But there was a few other factors as well. But so, you know, I think you have to offensively really be flexible and play to your personnel. And then defensively have a bunch of non-negotiables that also fit your personnel. And I think older coaches like me, we get better at that with time because we make mistakes and then we don't make the same mistake the next year. But I think anyone who's so set to their way of playing and not taking into consideration their personnel is a bad coach, frankly. I mean, if you have the ability to recruit like Coach Langle does, like Coach Langle recruits skilled, high IQ guys to play the style you guys play at Colgate. It's obvious when I watch you play. Tough, high IQ, skilled guys. That's why he was the first one on Tucker. You look at other places, you know, like, you know, Mick Cronin at Cincinnati for years, and he just wanted every guy to be 6'8", and just every guy to be a dog. He didn't care if they could shoot, right. Didn't care if they could dribble pass. It just put five dogs out on the court, and that's fine too. There's no right way to do it, but
right.
For Mick Cronin to recruit five dogs and then try to play like Colgate on offense, Simon, to your point, that wouldn't make any sense, right? And if you're a high school, like a public school, and you just get whoever you get, then you better be malleable, absolutely, or you're gonna fail.
Yep.
So even in situations where you get, let's say, like a big guy that comes in early and young and not very skilled. So I mean, when I'm watching the NBA that now it's coming back, when I'm watching the scrimmages and someone like Bol Bol is now like the face of the NBA because he's hitting threes at like 7'2". When you get like a big now who's not as skilled and you have time to kind of work with him and work on his skill set, are you putting him like with the guards now? I mean, that's like really the thing now. It's like bigs have to have guard skills to make an impact in the game. Like, are you having him shoot threes? Like that kind of thing. I guess it all depends on the player, but it is interesting just to ask like how the actual skill work breakdown is in practices and workouts and stuff for your bigs.
Yeah, I mean, I have a 7-foot Sudanese kid who's a rising junior this year, and he's only been playing basketball for 3 years, so relatively speaking, he's fairly raw. And he does all the 3-point shooting, all the ball handling, all the ball screen work that our 6'2" guards do. And you know, I think the game is going to be even more positionless as we go forward. And I don't want to be the guy that restricts his growth. Now, I may not let him shoot trail threes off of one pass yet, although I think he will be by his senior year, but he's going to shoot trail threes in practice in that scenario and gain his confidence. And he's going to put the ball on the deck in practice. The hard part, Tucker, as you know, and you've seen this with your buddy Gabe in our practices, is you give everybody this buffet of skill development, but then sometimes you have to back them off in the game, and that gets into role identification, right? So, right. You know, you give them as much as you can growing their skill, as much opportunity to grow their skill, but then in the games, they have to understand who in that moment they are, where their skill is, and also right. where their skill fits with their teammates. And that's where coaching comes in, right? Mm-hmm. And that's role identification and role acceptance, as Jeff Van Gundy says. You know, there's one thing for me to identify your role, Simon, as a spot-up shooter, you know what I mean? But then you have to accept your role. You might think, you know, you're a great driver off a ball screen, Simon, and I have to convince you that maybe you're not the guy who should be putting it on the deck, you know? So that's where the coaching piece comes in, Tuck.
And I guess that's also where shot quality comes in, because if someone's taking shots that they think are good shots for them or not taking shots that they think are bad shots for them, they can start to realize through something like shot quality where they should be making those plays. But I definitely agree. It's crazy to think I mean, I wasn't a coach and I'm not a coach, but I assume even 10 years ago, there was no way that you'd have a 7-footer who you were working on shooting threes and like, and dribbling, I guess, other than maybe like Luau and Charlie Villanueva and those guys.
I was going to say, Tucker, like, I think generally speaking, you're right. But like, because I had two lottery picks when they were 15 years old and they were both, you know, Lou's 6'8" and Charlie's 6'11", 7 feet. And they were so daggone talented, so young. I knew enough not to lock them in. Now, I knew then what I know now, we would have been even more spread out and they would have even had more space. I mean, one of them was always posting, but the other one was always on the perimeter, and 4-out-1-in 2001 was pretty radical. You know what I mean? It seems funny now, but like the fact that Charlie was putting it on the deck and shooting threes in 2001 in high school was pretty radical for that time. It wouldn't be radical at all now, but that made me grow quicker, Tucker. I think we had big guys playing on the perimeter way before most people did, because those guys showed me it was possible.
Right.
Wow. So this is another question that I really wanted to ask. So two questions that I seem to want to ask every single coach that we're going to have on. First one I already asked about being like malleable and adjusting. The second one about the hot hand, because I think you've watched more basketball than anyone, but the hot hand is a pretty divisive and contentious point, because data scientists and statisticians really believe that there's no empirical evidence to suggest that it exists. But then every player who's played the game, like Tuck said earlier, he's like, if you played basketball, you know the hot hand exists. So what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I did not play basketball as well as Tucker, but I know the hot hand exists. I have watched probably, 10 times more games than both of you put together. Definitely. I also think that's where we throw the shot quality stuff out the window. You know, if you have heat check guys that can get hot, like, Tucker's buddy Jalen Blakes, who's my rising senior guard, he's a kid that hit 5 threes in a state championship fourth quarter. 3 of those 5 threes were by the shot quality, probably bad shots. Gym packed, momentum flowing, a couple go in. I'm a big believer in, Jalen Blakes took us from up 1 in the state championship to up like double figures with a couple of shaky shot selection shots, but he had it going. I'm not a control freak as a coach. I want guys to play free. And so with all that being said, Simon, no matter what the data guys say, I'm letting the dude roll. And we talk about it in our practices all the time. That is a bad shot right there, unless he's made a couple, and the flip side is get him the daggone ball if he has made a couple. There's that piece to it too. That's a good shot for you most of the time, but Jalen Blake's just made 3 in a row. Get him the daggone ball. So there's both sides of the sort of hot hand thing. And the other side is defensively, you better know who's got the hot hand on the other team. He may need to be guarded differently for a 3 or 4 minute stretch to try to cool him off. Even if your data doesn't back that up, Simon, I'm going with that till the day they retire me and put me in a box.
That gives me that's giving me nightmares to the St. Benedict State Championship game right there, Coach. But yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, that's basically what I told Simon. It's like that's when kind of analytics and stats and all that stuff, you're right, it just kind of goes out the window, because you got to know yourself in the moment. And Jalen and a guy like Gabe, who I played with, guys like that can just get hot in moments of us. And I wonder how much of that. I mean, another question is just like, what are those guys like off the court? Are they more confident guys? Are they do they have more confidence in themselves, or even like a sort of cockiness? Obviously, I'm not saying those guys are cocky, but I wonder what you think there is a correlation between how a guy is, like his personality, and then a guy that can become like a heat check guy, because not everybody can do it.
Yeah, and that's where Simon and I, we have a bone to pick about, putting together teams. Your guy Daryl Morey putting together teams, but you have to. Bill Belichick is factoring in the mindset of players in a big way, as are most GMs in most American sports and sports across the world. Yes, there are certain guys that are just naturally more aggressive, more confident. You want your relief pitcher in baseball that if he gives up a 3-run homer on Tuesday night, that he thinks he's going to strike out the side on Wednesday night. Or the kid, Gabe Rabbits, who you played with, who plays at Wesleyan now, Tuck, who would miss 5 in a row and was damn sure that he was going to make the next 4,
Right.
And those guys have to be coached differently, I think. And I don't know where the data comes in. To me, that's the human aspect of coaching and playing. Like, that's a feel thing. And you're going to have to coach those guys differently. And frankly, as a teammate, you're going to sometimes have to interact with them differently. And I think teams that have great culture, they figure that stuff out. And I think, you know, you also look around at guys in the NBA like Trevor Ariza. Like, it seems like everywhere, and this is related, I'm not changing the subject, but like everywhere Trevor Ariza goes, the team gets better. I mean, how good were the Rockets with Trevor Ariza? Was that because he's a D and three guy, or is that because he's a great locker room guy? I mean, I think right. Luol Deng was the same. You know, there's certain guys that just uplift your locker room. There's certain guys that have crazy confidence, and I think you need those guys on your team to be a championship caliber team.
Yep, and I think some of these unquantifiable forces are so impactful, and just things that numbers won't do justice for, and shot quality won't. But interesting enough, so recently I did a study looking at team runs and how that impacts the shot quality of that team. So when you go on a 5-point run or more,
okay,
the momentum and shot quality actually increases at home, but not away. So maybe that's the crowd impacting the shot selection. I don't know. But at home, shot selection increases by like 30% compared to away, which is like a significant difference. So, I mean, that's an unquantifiable force where it's the crowd impacting the actual shot selection of the team, which is so, so interesting, I think, because that's something that most people wouldn't really consider to be empirical.
That is interesting. I also think that's a interesting point about the NBA playoffs this year, right? Playing in a neutral site with with no fans. I think that's going to be really interesting piece to all this, because there's teams that feed off of energy of the crowd in some cases, and others that it's not as important to. I wonder if those teams will be at a disadvantage in the NBA playoffs playing in the bubble. I don't know. I think it's one of the things I'm most interested in is what the runs will look like without the fans for the quote unquote home team.
Yep.
Are you at all kind of worried or apprehensive of the way that analytics is taking basketball? Like, do you kind of wish that it would be a little bit more subjective instead of objective, just as a coach and as someone who's like a fan of the game? Because for me personally, it's like the more data that you know, the more analytics, you kind of start to lose a little bit of what makes the game really fun. And I guess that's fine. I guess that's just the way it's headed. But I was wondering what your opinion is on that kind of stuff, on just the way you're going to be coaching the game now that there's so much more data. Is it more fun? Is it harder? Or is it harder to comprehend that kind of stuff?
Well, I feel pretty dumb how we coached the game 30 years ago. But as people remind me, if you don't know, it's not really dumb. So I watched during the quarantine in April, I was watching all the old March Madness games and, you know, watched Georgetown versus North Carolina, Pat Ewing versus Michael Jordan from the 80s. And I mean, there was literally like 8 people in the paint at times. I mean, it was disgusting. Like, right. I can't even believe we played. And that's how I played. I mean, that was the era that I played. I can't even believe we played basketball like that. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. We were all in each other's way. I mean, as a driving marginal Division III point guard back in the day, like, everybody was in the way. I mean, I would have loved to play the way we play now, you know. But the flip side is I don't love that every team in the NBA is starting to play kind of the same way. I mean, I know the Rockets are an outlier. They play even wilder than that. But I don't find the Rockets fun to watch. You know, I don't like James Harden, 50 James Harden ISOs, even though I understand it's really effective. And I'm enamored by the skill level that he has. I mean, he's an incredible basketball player. But I don't enjoy tuning in as a fan to watch that. I heard you say something like that, Tucker, on one of the previous pods, and I agree with you. I do hope there's a little bit of a swing that some people try to do some different things. Like this year, we're thinking about sending – there's a concept called tagging up, where you send all 5 guys to the offensive glass. And basically, if your guy leaks out, you leak out with him. But if your guy goes to rebound, you go. And I just think that there's going to be – they're doing that in Europe a lot right now. I think there's going to be concepts that people are going to do to offset the modern game the way it's played, because we can't all do it exactly the same way. And it's becoming so – at the NBA level, they all play alike. So – Yeah, I'm not sure it's as viewer friendly right now, Tucker, as I as it would have been even 10 years ago when teams had different styles.
Yeah, I don't think the future of the NBA or future of high school, or future of college is homogeneous. Like no way everyone's going to play the same way, because there aren't 30 James Hardens in the NBA. And I think crashing the offensive boards might be more effective for a team that has bigger, stronger, more effective box out players. So it really just depends on the talent you have and adjusting for the most efficient scheme that you can create.
Yep, I even think throwing to the post the way the Warriors did with Boga and running actions off of post catches, maybe not even throwing to the post to score per se, but using it as a different passing angle. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to play. So it is going to be interesting. I agree with you. I don't think it'll become totally homogeneous, but it's moving that way right now.
Even last week we were talking about it's similar to the offensive rebounding thing, but when you close out to a shooter, you just run down and try and get like a wide open layup instead of rebounding or boxing out. Yeah, it's like little things like that. But again, I mean, you kind of talked about how you guys might want to test it out, but a lot of teams are afraid of being like the test subjects of something like that, especially college teams, just because there's just a lot more on the line. But Simon's really into trying to get a team that knows they're going to be bad to try stuff like that. Just try anything to be like the test subject and see what it would be like.
Simon, I totally agree with you. Like look at Tony Bennett at Virginia, right? I would call him a friend. He goes into Virginia 10 years ago or whatever it was, and Duke and Carolina. And what are you going to do? You got to be different, right? Like, I mean, there's no better test case to use than Tony Bennett. I mean, Virginia decided they were going to play pack line defense and they were going to play slow on offense. And look at what he's done. And he's done it with less, you know. So whether you agree with it or not, if I'm a bottom conference team, I mean, even Colgate, like when Coach Langle got there, you know, I know they don't play totally different. They kind of play like Lafayette, and there's some teams in the league that play like you guys play. But, you know, instead of trying to get the highest rated guys he could get in the Patriot League, he got a bunch of tough, skilled, high IQ guys and played a style that would fit them. And you go from the bottom of the Patriot League to the top. I mean, you know, you got to have a plan, and then you got to get guys to fit the plan. And I agree with you, Simon. If you're in the bottom of a conference and you can't recruit the best guys to beat the best teams, then you better do something different. And yep. So for us, tagging up is going to be that. I mean, we may have the best players this year, but we're still going to try to do stuff differently. And I want to be out ahead of it. I want to grow as a coach, and there's an intellectual challenge to every year being a little bit different. And it really, I really learned that Tucker's year when I thought we were going to be bad and I decided I was going to be, you know, radical change. And so now every year is radical change for me. I'm trying to do something radical every year.
Wow. Yeah. I actually never even considered UVA as a innovative team, because I think of it as offensive innovation, but like the Rockets would be a great example of that. But I never even considered like the pack line defense or taking 28 second possessions as innovative, but it really is. Like doing something that other teams aren't is the key to being different and being that guinea pig. And so many teams and so many coaches are scared to do it because their job's on the line. If they make a mistake and they look like the they're the sole reason that made the mistake, if they try something new and it doesn't work. So that novel change scares coaches and it inhibits them from actually creating the best possible team that they can.
And it's another reason why college basketball is not as fun to watch anymore, because there's a lot of guys, and I understand it's not a criticism of the coaches. They're a lot better coaches than I am, but they coach scared because of the money that's on the line. And the eyes that are on them. And again, that's not a criticism of the coaches. I don't know that I wouldn't be the same way if I was in their shoes, but when you're coaching scared and you're trying to coach like other people coach, then you're not going to go for that radical change like you're talking about.
I was just curious, because you've coached so many college basketball players in general, and then a lot of obviously pros and stuff, that means that there's probably guys that have become more successful than others, and there's been some ups and downs with those, with the guys that have gone on to play college. So I was just wondering what attributes you find the most common in guys that are really successful from what you've seen, or guys that you've had personal relationships with, just as a player and as someone who's trying to like learn about coaching and that kind of stuff. What have you noticed from players that have gone on to be very successful?
Yeah. I mean, I can boil it down into a couple of things, and I'll be honest with you. I've never really said this out loud to anybody, but when a guy leaves my program, I'm pretty sure within about 90% whether a guy's going to be a pretty good college player or not. And what I base it on is, do they like the game or do they love the game? Like, Tucker, you loved basketball. Other guys like it. Are they tough and competitive marginally, or are they unbelievably tough and competitive? That's number two. And then, do they fall in love with the process of improvement or not? And so that's really the three things to me that it comes down to. If I was a GM of a pro team, you know, other than obvious just talent that you could put your eyes on, those would be the three factors that I would factor in. If I was recruiting at Colgate, that's what I would factor in. I think Klatsky and Lang will do that. And frankly, at Blair now, you know, I look at who's the kid's parents. Are they about what we're about? And then, does the kid have a growth mindset? Is he tough? And does he love basketball? And if they are, those are the kids that do well with us at Blair, and those are the kids that do well in college. It is a grind at the college level. If you don't love the process and don't love the game, it's really hard to be successful. You know that, Tucker.
Right.
I know which kids who leave my program are going to do well and which aren't, and I'm right almost all the time based on those parameters.
It was really cool being at Blair for me and being part of the cause over self kind of culture that you've built there. Earlier you talked about how Royal Ivy was the best leader that you've ever been around. And I just think personally, and for people listening, I was wondering what specific qualities he had just as a learning, you know, a way to learn, like what was he really good at being a leader and as a person? You speak so highly of him. So I was just curious.
Yeah. Well, he is an assistant with the Knicks now. And I think if he gets a couple of breaks, he'd be a head NBA coach. And he is the best leader I've ever been around, ever. At any level, as a 8 years as a college coach and 21 years at Blair. I think Roy was a great relationship builder. And then I think he had a way of holding his peers accountable in a way that almost no adolescent, he just had an air of confidence about him. He set an incredible example and he held people to the highest possible standard that he could.
Why didn't we hire him instead of Thibodeau? I mean,
maybe the next cycle around, Roy will be ready.
That'll probably be like 6 months or something, because it's pretty cyclical. I mean, I'm intrigued about this Nick head coaching signing. I mean, Thibodeau, this is kind of a great example of not being malleable. I mean, he didn't really adjust the system from the Celtics to the Bulls to the Timberwolves. It's kind of been the same. Okay, he kind of created the icing scream on defensive. He runs his players really hard. But he doesn't really have anything innovative about him. And that's why I'm apprehensive to how he's going to do as the Knicks head coach. I mean, obviously, it's a tough job to do in the first place. So that's why I didn't really understand hiring someone from college or someone that has a unique experience that has the ability to adapt and do something new or try something novel.
Well, he's a really, really bright guy, and he totally innovated NBA defenses.
Yeah.
In the mid, 2005, 2006, when he was a defensive coordinator with the Celtics, when he was a defensive coordinator for Houston, even for the Knicks back in the late 90s. What they did with loading to the ball side, bringing guys over the lane line against LeBron, and different things that they did with the Bulls and the Celtics, icing ball screens, as you said. That's really innovative stuff that's common practice now in the NBA, but that's all Tibbs. So I think you might find that he might innovate again. He's a really bright guy, and he's a mentor to my mentor. My mentor is Steve Clifford, who's the head coach of the Orlando Magic, and he's one of Cliff's mentors. And, you know, I think he's one of the smartest basketball minds in the NBA, and he's certainly going to bring stability and a work ethic and a positive culture. I mean, it has to be a step up from where your team is right now. And he's also, if you go back and, you know, Luol played for him at the Bulls, and Lou absolutely loved playing for Tibbs. I think the guys who are real warriors love to play for him. And I'm sure he will make some changes as well. But clearly those guys he was coaching in Minnesota were not Warriors. And so, you know, I wouldn't judge him on those years. If Derrick Rose doesn't get hurt, that team probably wins an NBA championship with Chicago that had it going. So I think you could make a lot of worse choices than Coach Tibbs.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I really hope it works out.
Coach, what are you thinking are the odds that we have a season this year? What are your thoughts on that? I'm curious. I've been asking around and I just want to get your thoughts on it.
Oh man, I don't know. I'd love for somebody to say we're just going to go to the springtime because this vaccine news is pretty positive, right? I mean, it looks like there's going to be a vaccine coming maybe earlier than some of us thought, but it all seems good when you're zoomed way out, but when the devil is in the details, right? The travel and the hotels and the game management, right, and some right. of that, it gets tough. And I think everybody's worried about liability. So I'm staying optimistic, but the devil's in the details, and I get a little less optimistic daily.
The good news is everybody at Blair is coming back, right? Or at least they're having in-person classes and all that kind of stuff.
Yep, in-person classes coming back. Hopefully we're going to be allowed to train in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, listen, we're doing the best we can. You know, I mean, we're trying to keep everything in the right priority. And as the old Nigerian proverb says, you know, the guy who did not have any shoes was mad until he met the guy without any feet. And so that's kind of where we're at right now.
I feel like that's a great way to end it off. Really appreciate having you on, Coach. It was great talking to you and keeping in touch. So good luck with everything that's going on. Are you going to be on any other podcasts coming up? I know you've been a hot commodity on the podcast.
I've been doing a lot of stuff with all these UK coaches over in Great Britain. I'm having a lot of fun doing some coaching the coaches stuff. But we'll see. I don't know who would possibly want to have me on their pod. But this has been fun, man. I'm a Nerdball fanboy, and I've really enjoyed it. You guys do a great job.
Thanks, Coach. You got to let us know when your podcast comes out because I'm really excited for that.
Good stuff. I'm going to have Simon be my first guest, man.
Awesome.
Be well, fellas. Stay safe.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Nerdball. We really appreciate it. And we hope to see you back here soon.
Woo!